From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. As a human rights lawyer in Pakistan, Asma Jahangir has defended a boy against the charge of blasphemy, the penalty would have been death, and defended the right of a woman to choose her own husband. In return, she's faced death threats. Last week, Jahangir was one of the recipients of the new Millennium Peace Prize for Women. On today's Fresh Air, we meet her. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Ralph Gleason's Jazz Casual TV series, which is being reissued on DVD and video. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews The Chris Isaak Show on Showtime, which stars singer and songwriter Chris Isaak. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. In Kuwait today, a U.S. Navy jet accidentally bombed a group of military personnel during a training exercise. A U.S. military official says at least six people, most of them Americans, were killed and at least six were injured in the accident. NPR's Tom Gelton reports.
The accident occurred during a live-fire training exercise on a bombing range in Kuwait. The Navy jet, an FA-18 Hornet based on the Harry S. Truman aircraft carrier, was in the Gulf to help enforce the no-fly zones in northern and southern Iraq. On a practice run, the Navy pilot dropped at least one bomb on one of the observer posts at the training range. A U.S. military official said the casualties were all military personnel from the United States and other countries that take part in the enforcement mission in Iraq. The U.S. military official says it's not clear whether the observers had any official function at the bombing range. Former President George Bush and retired Army General Norman Schwarzkopf watched a live bombing exercise at the Udari range last month when they were in Kuwait to mark the 10th anniversary of the end of the Gulf War. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.
The head of the Navy's Pacific Fleet Submarine Force said today that the commander of the USS Greenville was responsible for the collision that sank a Japanese fishing vessel and left nine people missing. Rear Admiral Albert Konecny told a Navy court in Pearl Harbor that Commander Scott Waddle had the absolute obligation to make sure that the area off the coast of Hawaii was clear before conducting an emergency surfacing drill. The admiral described Waddle as one of his best friends, but said the responsibility was the commander's. Earlier testimony faulted Waddle and his officer of the deck for conducting a hurried scan of the surrounding area with the sub's periscope. Only a year ago, the NASDAQ was in record territory above 5,000. Since then, the technology-loaded index has lost more than half its value, and the other stock market indices are also sharply lower. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
Fears over mounting corporate layoffs, coupled with the fact that many market analysts now expect the Federal Reserve may be less aggressive in cutting interest rates at its meeting later this month, conspired to pummel stocks. The tech-heavy NASDAQ index has now fallen to its lowest level in more than 2 years. Along with concerns about how aggressively the Fed might be willing to cut interest rates, technology investors also remain spooked by announcements of job cuts from the likes of Cisco and earnings warnings from mobile phone maker Ericsson. Meanwhile, the bloodletting wasn't just limited to the NASDAQ. Blue chip stocks also were hammered as the Dow suffered its fifth worst ever one-day point loss for a drop of more than 4%. For the NASDAQ, the decline of more than 6% took the index to its lowest close since December of 1998. Treasuries benefited from the decline in equities. The dollar showed only modest movement, up slightly against the euro and the yen. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
The Dow lost 436 points. The NASDAQ was down 128. This is NPR. Jury selection began today in the trial of an Algerian man accused of bringing bomb-making materials into the United States with plans for terrorist attacks. 33-year-old Ahmed Rassam was arrested in December of 1999 after he allegedly ferried a rented car full of explosives from Vancouver, Canada, to Port Angeles, Washington. Prosecutors said Rassam was a disciple of Saudi dissident Osama bin Laden and that he planned an attack during Millennium celebrations in Seattle or Los Angeles. Last week, another Algerian man pleaded guilty in New York to involvement in the plot. He's expected to testify against Rassam. Serbs and the ethnic Albanian community have agreed to a ceasefire designed to create a settlement after more than a year of border clashes. Guerrillas and Serbian security forces have been fighting along the boundary between Kosovo and Macedonia. The BBC's Paul Anderson reports.
NATO's special envoy to the Balkans, Peter Feit, hailed the ceasefire as a great step forward. Over the past 3 days, he and his military commanders have shuttled between Serbian government leaders and rebel commanders in their hillside bases close to Kosovo. For the Albanians, the chief sticking point has been the question of deploying Serb military forces to a tiny strip of land on the border with Macedonia. NATO invited the Serbs in to stop the flow of weapons and Albanian fighters across the border. The rebels, however, feared that after more than a year of bitter hostilities, the Serbs could use the deployment to crush a rebellion they've so far been powerless to stop.
Paul Anderson of the BBC. In stocks today, the NASDAQ Composite Index was down 128 points to close at 1924. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo Marriott Services, providing customized approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America on the web at SodexoMarriott.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Asma Jahangir, has been met with death threats in response to her work with Pakistan's women's and human rights movements. Last week, she was one of 6 winners of the new Millennium Peace Prize for Women, which is co-sponsored by the UN Development Fund for Women and the London-based human rights group International Alert. Jahangir and her sister, who also won a Millennium Peace Prize, were founders of the Women's Action Forum to help women obtain divorces from abusive husbands. In 1981, they founded the first all-women's law firm in Pakistan, and in 1986, they founded the Pakistan Human Rights Commission, which Jahangir headed. In 1998, the UN Commission on Human Rights appointed Jahangir Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial, Arbitrary, and Summary Executions. One of the issues she's taken on is so-called honor killings, a custom in which male relatives kill a female relative who has dishonored the family by, for example, committing adultery, divorcing a husband, or being the victim of rape. In 1999, honor killing in Pakistan came to international attention through the case of Saima Sarwar, a 29-year-old woman trying to divorce her husband. Sarwar's lawyer was Jahangir's sister. Jahangir helped on the case. When Sarwar first came to the law office, she was afraid.
Well, she expressed fear for her life, and her parents contacted me, in fact, and asked to see her. And I arranged one meeting with her parents, after which she went into our study, started talking to them, and then ran into my office saying, "They have come here to kill me. Please get me out of here." And I could see the expression on her face was very fearsome. So I just got her by the hand and took her to my colleague's room and said, "Just get her out of this office. She's very scared." We had a small meeting in the office, and we knew that this was a case where we will have to really protect our client. Her parents went to another very senior lawyer who called up my sister and said that the meeting should be scheduled again with the parents. Samia herself wanted to meet just the mother and said that she would only meet the mother, so it was arranged between the two lawyers that the mother would come to the office. She came in limping, pretending to have something wrong with her foot, and had a man helping her.
The mother came in limping?
The mother came in limping. As she opened the door to the office of my sister, who works in the same office and next door, this man just picked up his gun and shot at the girl, and she died instantly because my sister says she bent down to see and she was there no more. And we have, since many years, a police guard in the office, and this uncle and the other chap tried to shoot at him. The police shot back, and the killer himself died on the staircase of our office. Subsequently, we did bring the uncle to trial and the family. The uncle admitted that he had conspired to kill her, but in our country there is a law for which we have fought for years, which says that the family can forgive the murderer. And in the case of honor killings, it is always the family that murders women. And so he was forgiven, but we are still in appeal because we feel that as lawyers we can at least give them a run for their money and their sleep, if nothing else. And I certainly do believe that this is one of the cases where people were outraged. It has become a big issue, but before this there were many other cases.
Why did the family in this instance want the woman killed? Why did the mother want her own daughter killed?
I mean, it is something that you're asking me that I've never been able to explain to myself. Very recently I was in Turkey, for example, and I met a mother in jail who had also killed her daughter. And when I asked her, why did you do it? And she said, she was my own flesh and blood. I just was compelled to do it. I don't know what one is to take from here. And why do they kill is a kind of dehumanization that is just pent up inside, plus a society that has disrespect for women and a state that will not protect women. But I find absolutely what I cannot accept is that the state should be neutral in such a case.
You took on a case defending a woman named Saima Wahid. She had married against the wishes of her family, and her father wanted the courts to declare that marriage illegal because she chose her own husband against her family's wishes. Is that illegal, choosing your own husband?
Well, under the law, it's not illegal. But there had been isolated cases where bigoted judges had said that it was illegal. And all those cases were brought in this case, and that's why they wanted a final decision. And the fact of this case is, because she belonged to a family which was an Islamist family, very fundamentalist, very much militant family, that everybody was scared to, take up this case. Everybody was scared to rule on it, and there were demonstrations by their, people whom they sat with, like the fundamentalists themselves, the Islamists, I would call them. And there were these arguments, and there was this fear that the Pandora's box would open. And all this was said in court. Even there, the question of honor kept coming back and forth. And it was repulsive to me, because when they are talking about honor, what kind of an honorable thing is that? To get your daughter into court and humiliate her. What kind of honor is that? That you get your daughter into police stations.
So what was the outcome of the trial? Did you win the case?
Yes, we won the case. That's not the point. The girl couldn't stay in Pakistan. That is a sad point of it.
Was she had to flee the country after the case?
Yes, she is now living in Norway with her husband and has a very beautiful child. She's writing a book about herself.
What kind of precedent were you hoping to set with this trial?
Well, one, that we will not be browbeated. Second, we will not accept jerks on the bench to intimidate women lawyers.
Now, there have been groups that have put a price on your head and are calling for your death. What groups have been doing that?
There are four or five such groups which are militant jihadi groups, as we call them in Pakistan.
What does that mean?
Which means that they believe in holy wars, mm-hmm, and killing infidels. Yes, that is true. There is head money. That is true that I cannot walk around in Pakistan without a guard. It is true that I even sometimes go in a police car where the intelligence feels that there is imminent danger. I have come very close to death, seen it with my own, eyes, my car being smashed to smithereens. My family was taken hostage. So all this I have seen it. And that is why a greater commitment to continue to have a society that is more democratic and more secular.
What are the main issues? Like, if you could set new precedents in Pakistan, what are the first issues you'd want to take on?
Everything is just very connected there. So you can't say that if you will make the country secular and democratic, mm-hmm, then everything will follow. You have to do that. And I don't believe that you can call yourself democratic unless you don't have a backbone, which is a strong, independent judicial system. Because justice and democracy must go hand in hand. Our foreign policy, can you imagine that we have recognized the Taliban? People who go around, destroying statues, who don't allow women to come out. So that needs to be changed. We need to support more democratic cultures.
And in terms of women's issues, what are the laws or customs that you'd most like to change in Pakistan?
Well, many laws. There are many discriminatory laws. For example, the law of rape, the law of adultery, the law of evidence, family laws, because that affects every woman. And mind you, women's destiny in Pakistan is very much connected to the political system that we adopt.
You mentioned adultery. You've defended over 300 women accused of adultery. What is the penalty?
Well, the highest penalty is stoning to death, which has never been executed. But then it is anything up to 10 years of punishment and 30 whippings in public. Fortunately, when Benazir Bhutto was prime minister, she banned public whipping of women, banned whipping of women, period, which is a marvelous thing she did. But women do get arrested, and it's not in ones or twos, it's in thousands.
Of the women who you've defended who were accused of adultery, do you think that most of them actually committed adultery, or were these sometimes trumped-up charges to punish the woman?
Well, frankly, let me tell you, as a lawyer, I don't even bother and I don't even ask them whether they committed adultery or not. It's their business. But there are some cases which were horrific, for example, and these are not cases that I've done. These are cases that have been reported. A 13-year-old girl whose uncle said that she had been raped by her cousin, and the court felt that the cousin, they had to be given benefit of doubt. But since this child had got pregnant as a consequence of that rape, she was arrested. She was first given 100 stripes in public, and on appeal, the court said, which I find, you know, something inside me says, why? How can you do that? Says that we believe that in our society, justice and should be done, and we have to be kind to children. Therefore, we only give her 5 years. I said, oh. You know, when I'm reading it, I thought now it will say we'll release her. But 5 years, I mean, that's the kind of kindness they show to, you know, young girls. That case, there have been cases of a widow who gave birth to her child after her husband died, like a few months later. She was in jail when I met her, and she kept telling me my husband's only died 5 months ago. It took me 6 months and my colleague to find her death certificate, her husband's death certificate. Well, she was released after a year and a half, but she had 7 kids who were destroyed in the process, and this woman was destroyed. I remember her words, which always stuck in my mind. And she looks up at the sky and says, "Well, you up there, if you couldn't give us anything, for God's sake, don't give us that kind of injustice too."
Now, you're not just involved with women's rights cases. You also handle cases of workers who are just about slave laborers. What industry have you been working in?
I have worked in the bricklaying industry as a lawyer, where many families were enslaved, like bonded labor, forced labor. They were given sums of money and then kept for generations enslaved to the employer. Subsequently, this organization that I headed, Human Rights Commission of Pakistan, worked in Sindh with the Haris, the agricultural workers. We are continuing to work there, and my colleagues there have done fantastic work. They have got thousands of people released.
And how did slave labor become one of the issues that you took on?
It you know, these issues just, you come across them, you stumble across them. There was a nun who came to me and said this woman had been raped in a bricklaying. I went with her and I realized it was not just a matter of her woman being raped. It was a whole system that was so wrong there, the bonded labor system. And that's how I started working with the church there. And then a few other organizations I found were also working. And so I coordinated, unhappily, with even organizations that I didn't like, but one had to do it. And so that's how I took this on, using the instrument of law for their liberation, using media for campaign, using the opportunity of hearings in court to organize them into unions. So it really worked very well. And again, you know, you must realize one doesn't work alone. You have friends in the media who say, oh, great, this thing, this is a story, and we feel so bad about it. We have to cover it. And then you have other people in the even government who will say, yes, bring us a draft, we'll do something about it. And then there are others who will say, yes, we will come, like theater groups. They made plays out of it. And so others who organize them as unions. And that is the fun. When, you know, when you look at it from far, you say, this woman is under threat, what the hell is she doing? But I tell you, if I was born again, I'd do it again, because it's fun. You work with people who work with their hearts.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Asmar Jahangir, and she just won one of the new Millennium Peace Prizes for Women, which is co-sponsored by the UN Development Fund for Women. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Asmar Jahangir, and she is one of the recipients of the new Millennium Peace Prize for Women, which is co-sponsored by the UN Development Fund for Women and the International Alert, which is a London-based human rights group. She's the former head of the Human Rights Commission of Pakistan and is also a women's rights activist and lawyer in Pakistan. When you were growing up in Pakistan, were you from a family that believed in women's rights?
I don't think that women's rights was an issue at that point, but I believe that there was not much discrimination that I saw around me. I was treated the same way as my brother was. However, I did see a lot of domestic violence on women around me, and that used to upset me.
In your own family or in neighbors' families?
In my own extended family.
What did you see?
Husbands sort of beating up women, screaming at them, thinking that they must obey them, the question of obeying, you know, the men. You know, I was in one way very fortunate because my father was a politician, always in the opposition, so he spent about 7 years of his life in jail. So, I mean, you know, that way my mother was busy going back and forth. And so we grew up, as I say, as wild weeds, the four of us.
What was your father in jail for?
He believed in, you know, sort of, he was against military government, so that is why he was in jail constantly.
Now, you said when you were growing up, you were treated the same way that your brother was, and that women's rights wasn't the kind of issue that it is now. Did you observe things starting to change? Did you observe the climate becoming more restrictive and discriminatory for women?
I observed it, plus I experienced it, because when I got married, I realized, my God, I mean, you know, the expectations from a woman is to change and mold herself to something that she's not.
What was expected of you when you got married?
Well, I was expected to be a good, obedient girl, and I was not.
Expected by who? By your husband, his family? Society.
Well, by my husband, by the family. My husband more or less knew me, but was always on edge because the my would come out from inside me. And I was supposed to be this dutiful daughter-in-law, this lovely mother, cake baker. I was not. I didn't want to be. And I was miserable. And so when I had my first two daughters and I looked at myself in the mirror, you know, I had never been fat. I was getting fat all in the wrong places. And I looked like a little potato and dump. And I realized, no, this is not me. And I will not live a life of somebody else. That is when I thought the next day, out, Asmar Jahangir, out now. And I went, took the car keys, drove off to a friend who was a lawyer and said, let's start a law firm. And that's how it started.
And do you feel like the law or the culture around you became more conservative? That, do you feel that women lost any of their rights during the course of your life?
Well, in the days that I was going to college, there was freedom, I must say, in the sense of personal freedom. You could bicycle, you could wear what you wanted to. And then in the 80s came Mr. Ziaul Haq, supported by the West, the champion, the liberator of everything except women. And he put into place a policy and laws which were very anti-women. So it had its effect, a very unhealthy effect on the lives of women.
What were some of the laws he put into effect when he was head of state?
One of the laws was the law of adultery, for example, where a victim of rape can run the risk of being arrested herself. That was him. The law that, the same law, he started it, which subsequently became law, of forgiving a murderer. He was really an evil man. I'm sorry to say that. It's very difficult for me as an Eastern person to say that about somebody who's not there, but he was. So it had that way an effect. But on the other hand, there has been more awareness amongst women. And you see students now more aware of their rights, more assertive. We were not assertive of our rights. We got to know it later.
But I'm sure there's also a lot of women in Pakistan who think that the restrictions on women are just a part of their culture or religion, and therefore they have to accept it. Have you ever tried to convince women like that, that they shouldn't have to accept these restrictions?
Of course, there are a large number of women who find a lot of satisfaction in religious norms, and they accept it as the will of God. One does try and have a dialogue with them, if one can say it. You cannot force people to think differently. But I have also experienced something, that when a woman is in crisis and the choice is between herself and her religion, it's herself, mind you. For example, we do cases, custody cases, and a woman will come and say, what does Islamic law say? And that a boy after the age of 7 has to go to the husband. And I ask her, what do you think? I said, this is not fair. Well, if Islamic laws say that, will you drop your case? No, she's not going to drop her case.
She wants custody, is what you're saying.
She wants custody.
Mm-hmm.
So the point is that as long as it suits you, it gives you that kind of security around you, fine. But if it doesn't, then you have to first fight for your own rights, first fight for your own satisfaction. And women in Pakistan are no different. Mind you, the ordinary woman in Pakistan is a very wise woman. She's a survivor, a great survivor.
What's your religious background?
I'm a Muslim by birth.
Do you practice?
Well, I don't, in the sense that I think that religion is something that you are born into it, most of the people. And so that is it. I am God-fearing, and that's enough for me, wherever she is.
Asma Jahangir is a women's rights and human rights lawyer in Pakistan. Last week, she was one of 6 winners of the new Millennium Peace Prize for Women. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the rise of militant Islamic groups in Pakistan. We continue our conversation with human rights lawyer Asma Jahangir. Kevin Whitehead reviews Ralph Gleason's Jazz Casual TV series, which is being reissued on video and DVD. And David Bianculli reviews tonight's premiere of The Chris Isaak Show on Showtime.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Asma Jahangir, a women's rights and human rights lawyer in Pakistan. Last week, she was one of six winners of the new Millennium Peace Prize for Women. But in her own country, her work has been met with death threats and attacks on her family. Are there religious fundamentalist groups that have become more powerful in Pakistan and are asserting themselves in the government and in the legal system? And who are your opposition? And in other words, is there a rise of fundamentalism in Pakistan the way there is, say, in Afghanistan?
Of course, there has been a rise. I wouldn't even call it fundamentalism. I would call it militancy in the name of Islam. And because they were fighting first the jihad against, the Soviet Union, and then now fighting jihad against each other, both Muslims. I mean, you know, so how much can you call them fundamentalist? But they have become empowered. They have got a lot of money from various probably governments and people outside the country who fund them. They are armed to the teeth. They are entrenched in all institutions of Pakistan, whether it's judiciary, lawyers, education, ministries, politicians, and they have a very strong network. And I've experienced this because I have been on the receiving end. It's like if you put your finger on the pulse of one, they all feel the finger on their pulse. It's that kind of a network, you know. You twist one person's arm and you will hear the scream of the fifth person who's in another department. So that's how you know how strong their networks are. And our government has been unable to do anything about it because of their foreign policy.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think one of the groups that is calling for your death is the Peshawar Chamber of Commerce.
Yes.
They've demanded that you be arrested and hanged for creating a bad name for Pakistan and for encouraging girls and women to rebel against their families. I mean, I imagine in a way you'd plead guilty to that latter part, encouraging girls and women to rebel against their families, if their families refuse to give them any freedoms.
I just don't even react to this. I think bully to them. I mean, if the Chamber of Commerce is passing such edicts, how seriously do you expect me to take that Chamber of Commerce? Well, obviously, because one of their members' daughters had rebelled, they all felt that the Chamber has now suddenly got the powers to put head money. Really, I mean, this is heat of the moment. This is trying to intimidate. This is trying to harass. And I refuse to get harassed and intimidated by the likes of the chamber members.
But how do you function in your country when the Chamber of Commerce has put a price on your head?
Because I have a sense of humor. And I can get up in the morning and read, and I can say, oh, bloody hell, tell them to go away. Whatever.
But I'd imagine, I mean, the Chamber of Commerce usually represents all the local store owners. Does this mean you can't go into any store because all the businessmen want to see you hanged?
Believe me, that is not the case. After this great resolution of theirs, I was invited by the University of Peshawar, and I went there. I was received by a large number of students and teachers. The chamber called up the university vice chancellor and said I could not have the meeting in the university. It was shifted to a hotel which was jam-packed. And people from the Chamber of Commerce came to me and said, we are terribly sorry. We really were not there. We are not part of it. I moved very freely in Peshawar. And there is no such thing as animosity on the ground. It's these groups, it's these fundamentalist groups or militias or, you know, sort of mafias. And mafias, if you are beginning to take mafias sort of seriously, you have to take mafias as they are. They are criminals, and take them as they are.
So what kind of protection do you have?
I have protection. I have police protection. I have personal bodyguards. I have three sets of them. But believe me, that this is really psychological for the family. If they want to get me, they can get me. And every time that I have been saved, it's been by coincidence.
Give me an example.
An example that a man came to my office with a briefcase, sat right across me, saying he wants to give me some donation And I said, I don't take donation like this. And he was about to open his briefcase. I said, no, don't do that, because I don't take donations. And I could see he was sweating a little bit. So there's a button under my, table, and I rang it. And one person who's guards me came and opened the door and sat there. And then this man had a cup of tea with me and went away. And subsequently, I was told that he had gone and killed one of the judges in one of the cases where I had fought for this boy, young boy, who was accused of blasphemy, and this judge had acquitted him. And so it was the same man who sat right across me. He had come to kill me because the same day he killed the judge.
What was this case? Tell us more about the case.
This was three people, including one boy who was 14 years old, and the allegation against him was that he had committed blasphemy, written something on the wall of a mosque. Nobody would say what he'd written, because if they said it, that would be blasphemy too. So no lawyer would take their case. The one who did initially, they had put kerosene on his chambers, around his chamber, and threatened him. So he left the case, and that's how I then took the case. And this young boy had heard my name in the jail and told a group of people who went there, why doesn't this woman lawyer come for me? And I found that really very touching. And so I did take up this case. And it was basically this case that really had put me into, the chambers, so to speak. And that is when I started getting official protection. That was a very, very ugly case. There were hundreds of people outside the courtroom asking for their death, my death. One out of the three of them was shot dead outside the court. And these two who were finally acquitted, first convicted of death penalty, then finally acquitted, were flown off to Germany by the government because they couldn't keep them there. And the judge who acquitted them, one of them, there were two judges, one was murdered. And it was on this case that the five people came and took my family hostage, my brother, his kids, and wanted him to call me. But somehow that was the worst, I think, that I've experienced in my life, and the kind of ammunition that they got. So they were arrested, they were found, but the man who sent them was not arrested, because nobody dared arrest him, because he was such a big Islamic scholar who's never read a book in his life.
So did you ever find out what it was that this boy was alleged to have written that was so blasphemous?
No, I didn't, because they wouldn't say what.
That's amazing.
And and he was convicted first, mind you, on an evidence of saying he wrote something, but we can't say what. And out of the three people who were supposed to have seen what he's written, one said that he hadn't seen it. And I mean, it was a case of no evidence. But the atmosphere that they create there, that is so harrowing, the atmosphere. It terrorizes you. So the first lesson is that you take terror out of your heart and mind and throw it away. Otherwise, you can't fight it.
Now, when you say that, I mean, are you prepared to die for the causes that you support?
Look, nobody thinks about it in this way. I am certainly not a martyr kind of a person. I love my life. But if one has to, then there is nothing more nobler a cause that I can think of. And apart from everything else, please try and understand, I really enjoy what I do. I love it. It's life for me. I cannot bear to live where there is so much injustice and I cannot do something about it. What kind of a torturous life is that?
Now, you just became one of the first recipients of the New Millennium Peace Prize for Women. You and five other women were the first women to get this award, and this was just a few days ago. And the award is co-sponsored by the UN Development Fund for Women and a human rights group called International Alert. Do you think that winning this award will help you anyway in Pakistan?
Winning this award is important for me because it places far more responsibility on me. And this award is for peace. I take this award as an incentive for further initiatives. And this award I have accepted in the name of the activist women of the subcontinent. I think that it is not us, it has been the Indian women, just as much as us, who took the initiative for peace. By we, I mean women of Bangladesh, India, and Pakistan, and activist women I am talking about, have been able to rise above boundaries, have been able to reach out to each other, have been able to express our fears and terrors in the face of violence and wars that loom around our atmosphere. So I take it in their name, and I will take this award to Delhi to share it with my friends there, and then hopefully we can do the same and take it to Dhaka. So it is just a more of an opportunity of strengthening of our bonds. There is truly sisterhood global in that subcontinent.
Well, I'm wondering about that, about how much of an international women's movement you feel, you know, how connected you feel to women's movements in other countries.
I don't really look at it in terms of women's movement. I look at it in terms of human rights movement.
Mm-hmm.
And I am very much connected. I really did start as a human rights person. I mean, women's rights is a very important part of my life. But I think that women will only get their rights if other people get it too. So for me, children's rights, for me, the rights of religious minorities, the right of labor is important. So yes, I feel very strongly with them. I find a lot of support. It has helped my work. In fact, in times when I've been in extreme danger, it has been our friends around the globe that have made life miserable for our foreign minister, who told me that sacks and sacks of letters come for you. And it made life miserable for our interior minister, who once just scratched his head and said, "Can you tell them to stop writing, please? I've heard it." And I said, "I cannot tell them to stop writing because I do not know where they are. And you need to hear again and again. And you will keep hearing. Till as long as I am living under threat, you will keep hearing."
Asma Jahangir, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
And I wish you good luck and safety.
Thank you.
Asma Jahangir is a women's rights and human rights lawyer in Pakistan. Last week, she was one of six winners of the New Millennium Peace Prize for Women. Her work is featured in Speak Truth to Power, a human rights project presenting stories of women and men who have stood up to oppression at great personal risk. Coming up, Kevin Whitehead reviews Ralph Gleason's Jazz Casual TV series, which is being released on video and DVD. This is Fresh Air. Critic Kevin Whitehead says one unintended consequence of Ken Burns' recent 19-hour jazz series is to highlight how infrequently PBS covers jazz at all. When it has, Kevin says, we've been treated to misguided efforts like a 1980s tribute to Duke Ellington that trotted out actor Treat Williams to sing Satin Doll. By contrast, the 1960s was a golden age of jazz on American TV, with locally produced series like Jazz Scene USA, Frankly Jazz, and Jazz Casual. Jazz Casual is now being released in a series of DVDs and home videos. Kevin has a review.
Art Farmer on flugelhorn and Jim Hall on guitar, from a segment of Jazz Casual aired in 1964. It's one of three newly released episodes, the others featuring the Jerry Mulligan Quartet and Woody Herman's Big Band. Jazz Casual was an occasional half-hour show, produced between 1960 and 68 for National Educational Television, the forerunner of PBS. 14 episodes have been issued so far on individual video cassettes from Rhino, who have also put out a few on DVD, three shows per disc. Looking at the latest batch prompted me to go back and watch the rest of the series. It's a textbook example of the right way to present jazz on TV. Sonny Rollins from an exceptional 1962 broadcast, with Jim Hall again on guitar, Bob Cranshaw on bass, and Ben Riley on drums. Each episode of Jazz Casual was crammed with music, from the opening seconds till the final fade-out. Two cameras covered the action in close-ups and medium shots. After the first tune, the leader would be interviewed for a few minutes by the show's host and producer, critic Ralph Gleason. He put musicians at ease with his body language, slouching in a chair, legs crossed, elbows out, and fingers interlaced. He's casual but attentive. Gleason asks good questions and never wastes time with small talk, zeroing in on the music. Here he is with Sonny Rollins, not the easiest guy to interview, trying to get at the nuts and bolts of his group improvising.
Do you ever vary the tempos in which you play tunes from performance to performance?
Occasionally, although we usually have a set idea of what would be the best tempo for any particular song, and there might be very slight, not too much. It might go a little bit faster, a little slower, but by and large, I think we do everything about the same thing that we agree upon.
How about keys? Do you ever change the key or something?
Yeah, we do that. And we're just beginning to do a lot more of that, to play in keys which we might not have played in too much before. So now we play the same song and we're beginning to play it in different keys. And of course, each key gives it a different sound. Once again, it makes it a little different. The same notes in a different key would produce a different color, you know.
This makes you think about it in a new way then.
Definitely,
It produces new versions then.
Exactly. Very interesting.
For a few episodes, Gleason varies his own formula a bit. He sits at the piano and talks about the good old days in Kansas City and elsewhere with blues shouter Jimmy Rushing, who's a good piano player, and also with Count Basie, who appears in a compact quartet.
But really the main guy that really influenced me was Thomas Svetzwaller. That was the man that that I really did idolize, because Fats taught me how to play what little bit of organ that I do know, and I used to watch him and lay around him long enough to try to style a little piano after him, which was quite difficult.
You still do Fats Waller tunes, don't you, with the band?
Oh, yes, Nat Pierce just made an arrangement on one of Fats' goodies, a little thing called Squeeze Me, which we think quite a bit of. But and a lot of things, a handful of keys, Nat made an arrangement on that too. After all these years, Nat finally made an arrangement on a handful of keys, which is going to be kind of hard because it goes. Can't get no further than that with that one. So we'll cool it right there.
That's Basie's only documented version of Handful of Keys, by the way, and a rare peek at the formidable chops he usually kept hidden. In general, the musicians comport themselves well, with a couple of exceptions. Dave Brubeck plugs his records over and over, and Mel Torme mugs for the camera and butters up the host. John Coltrane declined to be interviewed, but that did give him more time to play. For me, the very best episodes are devoted to Rollins, Basie, Jimmy Rushing, and singer Carmen McRae. Without an audience, she's less formal with her musicians than she'd be in concert, visibly surprising her pianist by talking to him between songs. I like this series a lot, so won't tread too heavily on the various mangled names of musicians and tunes and some incorrect air dates, which are listed on the boxes, or the 6-minute profile of Ralph Gleason that introduces each episode. As Gleason himself knew, these shows were never about him. That's one reason they pack so much jazzy pleasure into a short 30 minutes.
I'm gonna lock my heart and throw away the key, 'cause I'm wise to all those tricks you played on me. I'm gonna turn my back on love, gonna snub the moon above, seal all my windows up with tin so the love bug can't get in. I'm gonna park my romance right along the curb, hang a sign upon my heart, please don't disturb. 'Cause if I never fall in love again, that's soon enough for me. I'm gonna lock
Kevin Whitehead is currently based in Chicago. He reviewed Ralph Gleason's Jazz Casual TV series, which is being released on DVD and video. Coming up, David Bianculli reviews the new Chris Isaak show, in which the singer and songwriter plays himself. This is Fresh Air. Tonight on the Showtime cable network, musician Chris Isaak stars in a new weekly TV series that bears his name. But the Chris Isaak Show isn't a variety show. It's a comedy, with occasional music and with Isaac and his band basically playing themselves. TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
If Chris Isaak had come to television in a standard variety show, that would be daring enough. Variety, after all, is one of the deadest genres on TV now that the quiz show is back. But Isaak, clearly a fan of what Gary Shandling did on HBO with The Larry Sanders Show, has popped up on Showtime with a series taking a somewhat satirical look at the life of a second-tier pop star, a pop star named Chris Isaak. The show is Isaac's idea, fleshed out with help from writer-producers Diane Frolov and Andrew Schneider. They're from Northern Exposure, and the Chris Isaak Show has that same wonderful, goofy quality. Three members of Isaac's real band are mixed with fictional characters who portray his keyboard player and his management staff. Meanwhile, real-life celebrities and musicians guest star each week, playing comically exaggerated versions of themselves. Tonight, it's actress Bai Ling, a former girlfriend of Isaac's, in real life and on the show, who shows an unexpectedly wild comic side. In the coming weeks, it's people like Joe Walsh and Minnie Driver. And in tonight's pilot, there's a special appearance by Chris Isaak's mother, a therapist, playing Chris Isaak's mother, a therapist. He's calling her because he's freaked out by a woman on his video shoot. By day, she's a prim and proper production assistant. At night, she performs sexy strip teases at her hotel window, which Chris can see, but which she denies the next morning. The phone conversation plays well enough on its own, but even better if you know it's his real mother and that it's based on an actual incident that once happened to him on the road.
It sounds to me, honey, like you're very interested in this young woman.
Mom, this is not about me, okay? What makes a person act like that?
Well, it's pretty straightforward to me.
Straightforward?
Yes, don't you think so?
No, but then I'm not a drummer.
Maybe you wouldn't find this woman's behavior so puzzling if you had a better understanding of your own libidinal drives, your own...
masturbation fantasies.
Mom, hey, let's not talk about me, okay?
You know, sweetheart.
The two of you are very much alike.
What do you mean that she and I are alike?
Well, she sublimates her sexual impulses by dancing in front of a window. You sublimate yours dancing in front of an audience.
Ouch, Mom. Come out swinging, don't you?
You know, you're not aware of the
sexual overtones of what you do for a living.
Well, my battery's going dead. Can we talk about her?
Chris,
it's always easier to focus on the other person
instead of dealing with our own issues.
The overall formula of the Chris Isaak Show isn't that daring. Following a star at work and at home, and throwing in celebrities who play themselves, is the same basic blueprint of such 50-year-old TV classics as the Jack Benny program and I Love Lucy. But like the Larry Sanders Show, the Chris Isaak Show takes advantage of the freedom of cable and has its own terrific in-house band to boot. The secret weapon in Isaac's show is Jed Reese, who plays the fictional role of keyboard player Anson. He's the bad boy of the group, sort of like an even less mature version of Jack Nicholson's character in Five Easy Pieces. Yet he's a very funny character and has a lot of heart. So does a naked woman named Mona, played by Bobby Jo Moore, whose role is too complicated to explain here. The shorthand, I guess, would be a nude conscience, Hugh Hefner's version of Jiminy Cricket. But like this entire show, you almost have to see it to believe it. And I strongly suggest you do.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Monique Nazareth, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, and Patty Leswing. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Baby did a bad, bad thing. Baby did a bad, bad thing. Baby did a bad, bad thing.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Books Division, publisher of The Wisdom of Menopause, Creating Physical and Emotional Health and Healing During the Change by Dr. Christiane Northrup. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet one of the leading revisionist historians who is reinterpreting the story of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict based on new source material. We talk with Avi Shlaim, a professor at Oxford University and author of The Iron Wall, Israel and the Arab World. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.